Hello, TV Land?
Thank you.
How are you? Apparently, we have not been able to connect with Green Bay, but there's nobody there anyway, so it works for me. We have got a great panel today to talk about free trial best practices. I'm the only judge in Milwaukee. The other three are in FJC, Federal Judicial Center Training in San Diego. Therefore, they left me in charge. Therefore, the first thing I'm doing is repealing all the local rules. All the local rules in the Eastern District of Wisconsin no longer enforce in effect. Just kidding, of course. But thank all of you for coming for this great panel. Now, September, normally we would have our Lou Jones on the second Tuesday of the month. We will be skipping September. Instead, you're all very welcome to come on over on Friday, September 13th, 12 noon, we're having a Pro Se Help Desk 2-credit course CLE. This is for people who volunteer, for people who are interested in volunteering, for people who have, I know some of the bigger firms, they're not able to really volunteer, so some of them have made some financial support to the Pro Se Help Desk. You're welcome to come and bond up with the judges and have some free food and get 2 free CLE credits. We're still working on an ethics component, but for sure you'll get 2 credits, whether one of them is ethics is kind of up in the air. Please come on, all 4 judges will be here, Angie will be here. We're gonna have a really good presentation, very basic for some of you new folks who would like to learn more about, you know, Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the Pro Se Help Desk, etc. That is, again, Friday, September 13th, 12 noon, in this room, also connecting to Green Bay, we hope. So please come back, but don't come here Tuesday, the second Tuesday for Lou Jones. We won't be having it. We're back on in October, and we're going to have a lien stripping program. Judge Pepper is going to be on the panel, and I'm not sure who else is going to present, but that's the most common adversary proceeding that we're seeing right now, is the Chapter 13 lien strip. So come on back and learn all about that, how to get your orders, what they should say, what are the tips for serving it. We're going to have some of that today. Today's panel is Heidi Miller, Nathan De Laderante, Melissa Blair, and Jack Zaharopoulos. We thank them very much. They're going to present pretrial practices. Thanks again.
Thanks, Judge Kelly. One of the things that I've discovered about Lou Jones is the first key to speaking is to surround yourself with as many people as possible. That way, if you say something incorrect, you can both shift the blame and the responsibility. So when Ryan Blay first approached me about this, I thought, well, okay, let's find some people that are smart and really good. That way, in case we screw something up, it's not just me up here. The second thing that I've always found interesting about this is I've spoken a few times. It's always a little bit difficult when I look out and I think, okay, that person's been doing this longer than I've been alive. So take today as nothing more than maybe perhaps some ideas, thoughts, and some research from a few of us.
Bob Watt is the only one in the room that's true.
Well,
why are you picking on Bob Watt?
Close to that. But nonetheless, it's always a good exercise to put these things together. I always learn something new, and it usually ends up helping me in a case. So if you get a chance, if Ryan hits you up to speak, take advantage of that opportunity. It's always a good learning exercise. I'm going to turn it now over to Heidi Miller. Heidi and I work together. She's going to walk us through some of the basic jurisdictional elements of an adversary proceeding.
Okay, so like Nathan said, we're going to start with jurisdiction. I know that's pretty basic, but you want to make sure if you're bringing an AP that it can correctly be brought in the bankruptcy court. So just back all the way up, the bankruptcy court was created by Article 1 of the United States Constitution, and Title 28 sets up the framework for bankruptcy judges, and actually the bankruptcy court kind of acts as a unit of the district court. And then Title 11 goes into the jurisdiction of bankruptcy judges. So we have our core versus our non-core proceedings. So if something's non-core, that's going to mean that it's not technically related to bankruptcy, but it might relate to the case that you have. So bankruptcy judges, they can hear and make decisions on non-core proceedings, but only if it relates to the bankruptcy case. And if it's a non-court proceeding, then the parties need to consent to jurisdiction. And if they don't consent, then the bankruptcy judge can basically send it up to the district court, and the district court can decide. And the court proceedings are laid out in 28 U.S.C. 157B. Now, one case you've probably all heard about is Stern v. Marshall, which came out in 2011 by the Supreme Court of the United States. And so with that case, the Supreme Court decided there was a counterclaim that was brought that wasn't related to the bankruptcy case, and the Supreme Court said no, the judges didn't have jurisdiction to hear that. Obviously, as a plaintiff, you're going to make sure that your case is related to the bankruptcy if it's a non-core claim. But just watch that it does relate, and then also if you're a defendant, you can't just bring anything.
And Heidi did lose the coin toss and having to talk about Stern v. Marshall, just so everyone knows, as well as not getting to talk about Ortiz in front of Judge Kelly. So, thank you, Heidi.
All right.
Can I just throw in that she mentioned, and with all, what we've always thought, that if you consent to the bankruptcy court hearing your non-core proceeding, or even some of these that are defined as core. Counterclaims were defined as core, but the Supreme Court found in Stern versus Marshall that didn't matter. It wasn't the type of proceeding that a bankruptcy judge who doesn't have lifetime tenure like an Article III district court judge could decide. Well, so then the case came down, well, what about if the parties consent? And the Ninth Circuit, in a case called Bellingham Insurance, ruled that it would be okay if the parties consent. And in that case, because the defendant didn't raise the problem until after the decision was made, the Ninth Circuit said, you're deemed to have consent, and you've waived your right to object to the bankruptcy court issuing a final order on this, and it happened to be a fraudulent conveyance action. That case has now had cert accepted. In May, the Supreme Court decided to take that case. So keep an eye out for that. Hopefully, they are going to maybe clean up a little bit of the confusion that was caused in Stern versus Marshall, or just make a thing that if you don't absolutely consent, no bankruptcy court should be hearing this, it should go to the district court or whatever. But again, watch for the case of Bellingham Insurance coming out of the Supreme Court the next term.
Judge Kelly, do you see anyone not consenting to jurisdiction?
All the time. Yes, they don't consent. And then that goes up to the district court, where they are very busy with other types of cases, criminal, et cetera, and so it can take longer. So yes. In the big Chapter 11 cases, it is one of their strategies, sure, to not consent. It also, in the consumer cases, we have these what I would call the lender liability type cases, where a debtor is suing and saying, you don't own the note, your mortgage wasn't assigned correctly. Now, if you think about it, this is not a bankruptcy. This doesn't arise out of the bankruptcy code or something like that. The ability of the creditor to foreclose a mortgage or to assign a note. So, again, on those cases, we're starting to see motion to withdraw the reference or objection to the bankruptcy court making the decision. So, again, those are consumer cases. Upstairs to the district court, they're going.
Thanks.
Okay, so going into case filing, what type of cases can be filed as, or what are the normal adversary proceedings rule, or Section 7, Part 7 of the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure contain all the procedural law, and a lot of them mirror and incorporate the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. But there are 10 types of adversary proceedings that are listed in Rule 7001. So those are turnover of property, lien strip, which Judge Kelly had mentioned that's where they're seeing a lot of their APs right now, Approval of sale, challenge to discharge, revoking the confirmation of a plan, challenges to determine dischargeability, proceedings to obtain injunction, proceedings to subordinate any claim, allowed claim or interest to obtain a declaratory judgment, or to determine a claim or cause of action removed under 28 U.S.C. 1452. So these are just some that are listed in the rules where these would be brought as adversary proceedings. I think I'm going to turn it over to Melissa.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the initiation of an adversary proceeding. There is a local rule on this. It's Rule 7004. And at that rule will refer you to an appendix. And when you, and this is from the Eastern District Bankruptcy Court website. When you click on the link, you get to this document, which was included in the handout. It shows the minimum filing requirement is a complaint. The fee is, I think it's $293. If the adversary proceeding is commenced by a debtor, there isn't a fee. There's also a list of a cover sheet and a summons. And if you, and the official form numbers are there, if you follow the link to those forms, you'll see in the adversary proceeding cover sheet and also a summons. These are only for conventional filers, which means that they're not e-filers, which is pretty rare. So if you go to the after those forms, there's a link from the website that describes the procedure for an electronic summons to be issued, which most people use who are electronic filers. And what it says is that the electronic copy of the summons and a certificate of service will be served electronically on plaintiff's counsel. So what happens is once you go and e-file the complaint, you'll get an email, and I attach one just that I received recently, and that attaches the summons and the complaints, and it also includes the answer date and the date for the pretrial conference. So the form copy of the summons and complaint also is included in the attachment.
And then most of this docket text has entered too, right?
Right, and there's also a link to the docket where these documents are available. I'm told that the form summons is changing just recently. As of right now, it says that the telephone conference is initiated by the court. So at the pretrial conference, as it is now, the court will actually call, get all parties on the line. That's going to be changed, so people, there's an 800 number,
I assume. That's just for my cases, and this is something brand new, and I'm working on a little announcement of it. And we brought actual copies, and anybody who's picked up the outline here should grab one of the new ones. So in my cases, rather than us calling you, and this is going to be for all telephone hearings, actually, rather than us calling you, you're going to be calling us. We'll have an 800 number with a little code to put in, and we'll help you out and remind you as, you know, to get people used to it. But our new procedure is going to be that you'll be calling us. We won't call you.
Okay.
When is that starting?
Yeah, we're sort of rolling it out right now. Our goal was September 1st, but we've got the phone line. We've got the number. We're working up the forms. And so on Chapter 13 day, rather than us, you know, calling and we get your receptionist and she's, you know, filling in for somebody on maternity leave, so she doesn't know what Judge Kelly's court calling for a hearing really means and puts us on hold, and, you know, I start having smoke coming out of my ears. We're not having that anymore. You're just going to call into this number, and it'll be a little bizarre because it won't be like you're sitting on hold with Paula or something like that. You will be on a conference line, and the other hearings will be going on. So you're going to be calling in, and you're going to be hearing people talking, and that's going to be the case that's ahead of you. This is how Judge Fury does it in Eau Claire. I filled in for her recently, and I said, hey, this works pretty slick. I think we'll give it a try. So I think it is going to be a little different for the lawyers, but once you get used to it, I think you'll find, you know, it's just the same, except instead of us calling you, you'll call us.
Okay.
My poor receptionist now, I think, will like that.
Yes, receptionist should like that.
Very much should. They have the fear
of God. And Jody is like, you know, she's liking it quite a bit. So she's the one that had to make those calls and watch me go, how long have you been holding? How long have you been holding? And Attorney De La Torrente, I love him, but I had so much trouble connecting with him for a while that I denied him telephone hearing privileges until I got over it, and now he's back in the program.
Back in good graces.
Yeah.
Okay, so it'll be important to watch for any Judge Kelly's adversary cases for when that case or when that change is made. So with the other courts, as of now, the court, it sounds like, will still initiate the call for the pretrial conference. In terms of after you get the email attaching the summons, then you have to serve it, obviously. I included the rule for service, which is Rule 7004, and I also highlighted some of the ones that you see most often. On an individual, you can mail it to the person's last known place of or their residence. On a domestic or foreign corporation or a partnership, you can mail it, but it has to be to the attention of an officer, a managing or general agent, or to any other agent authorized by appointment of law to accept service of process. And then also on an insured depository institution, it must be sent by certified mail addressed to an officer of the institution. There's a couple of exceptions, but those are the ones that we usually see. The time limit is that the summons has to be served within 14 days after it's issued or it's stale. If you somehow just miss the 14 days, I believe you can just call the court, ask for another summons to be issued. You'll get the new email. And I also included Judge Kelly has some procedures for service of the adversary complaint available on the website. I printed those off too. That goes through, I think, a lot of the things that the court sees, problems with service on a daily basis. So there's a lot of information available on the website from all the judges about how to go about filing and serving an adversary summons and complaint.
I think the one that it can trip up some creditors is the serving the debtor. You have to serve the debtor by snail mail, and you can serve the debtor's lawyer by electronically, but you have to serve additionally the debtor by snail mail. Not certified mail, and not a sheriff to the debtor's house. I've had some people do that because they think that's what you do in state court. Debtor by snail mail and debtor's attorney can be done electronically. That seems to trip some people up. And you're like, how do I find the debtor's last known address? The one in the petition, the one that the court has is the one to use. That will be perfectly fine.
I think one comment that I would make is that, especially if you're doing any type of a lien strip or some other type of related matter, check to see if the institution is FDIC insured. Some of them aren't, which is going to trip up a potential service-related issue because you need to be going via first-class mail versus registered.
Isn't there a website that you can check? What's that website?
It's FDIC.gov. Okay. Just type in the institution's name and find out. You'd be surprised how many of them aren't.
Yeah, like Landmark Credit Union, not.
Correct.
Not.
Doug?
How are you establishing who a corporate officer is on a given day if you're serving Bob Smith or Mary Jones, president?
I'll defer to Melissa on that one. I've got some different ways that I do it.
Well, you can also serve a registered agent as well.
Right, so you can look up the registered agent. I've had people call and just ask whoever answers the phone. Sometimes you can get it that way.
Or if you can go to
internet searches.
Yeah. WDFI.org links you to this Department of Financial Institutions website through the state, mm-hmm. and you can pick up the registered agent there. There's another way.
It can be an officer. So if you know the officer, if it's Associated Bank or your local bank, you can serve that vice president that your guys have been dealing with. Some of these institutions, though, I think they go to the website. And what, Jamie Dimon, is he Bank of America or one of them? That's who I see whose name is on these things. He's an officer.
Right.
I was going to say, we go sometimes to the website, Associated Bank, for example, on a given day, look who the president is,
right.
Print that, and serve that John
It's a great comment from Doug Mann, is that just going to the institution's website, pulling up who the president is or another officer at that point in time, printing it off, and then serving it on that person. I have had judges during pretrials tell me that they have Googled and said, hey, I think you got the wrong person this time, and I've had to reserve. It does happen. Jay?
Well, what about entities that have gone out of business? What I run into is an official required by HBSC, and I've tracked through that several times. Any suggestions there? We've got a non-existent entity, though, I'm assuming it was not acquired by somebody.
The question is dealing with non-existent entities that haven't been acquired by anybody. I'm going to look a little bit at Heidi and see if she has some ideas. We deal, not in the bankruptcy context, but up in district court on like FDCPA type of violations where you're looking at a debt that's been acquired by a third party. So I think that would be the closest idea that I have. And I would look for I call it the last man standing rule, see whoever that person happens to be, serve them, and see where it goes. But I'll defer to anyone else on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that would be an odd situation if it has not been acquired by anyone. I don't know. I think Nathan's rule sounds like it'd be the only one that would work.
We're going to move through some different discovery-related tools. I'm not going to bore everyone to death. You know, we've all been through law school. We know what the basics of these are. I just want to highlight a couple of things that I noticed from a practice standpoint and how they work and some things to keep track of. Let's talk about depots. Love them. You get to spend a lot of time prepping for them. You get to grill people, get to be mean. It's my favorite thing to do. And Heidi knows that I really get a big kick out of that and not get to have a lot of fun. However, it gets a little bit interesting when you look at doing a deposition on a party versus a non-party. The fun part about parties is you get to haul them back to your own office and do it there, which is good because then I've got wireless, I've got my laptop, I've got all the things that I need, and I have access to that stuff. It gets a little bit stickier when we look at doing a deposition on somebody who's going to be a witness potentially to the matter, but doesn't happen to be a party. You only get to drag them for 100 miles. That's it. They don't have to travel any further. I personally am not mean. I do know that there are folks that make that poor person travel 99.5 miles to some hotel and do a deposition there. To me, there's no sense in doing that in this life. Try to make it at least a little bit simpler on the parties. The key is when you serve that notice of intent to take a deposition on that party, you need to do two things. First off, it needs to issue from the district where the deposition is going to take place. So in other words, if I'm going to the Central District of California because I need to do a deposition on somebody from Bank of America, I can't serve them with a subpoena from here in Wisconsin. It needs to issue from the district where that party is located. You're allowed to sign that as an officer of the court. Done it before, works fine. The second aspect is that you need to include both the mileage and the witness fee. It's whatever the current IRS rate is for mileage goes. Use Google, you know, Google Maps. I figure that if I get into a dispute about paying that, I'll stick with Google's numbers. And then the witness fee, I'm going to turn to Heidi. Is it 40?
I think that sounds about right.
Yeah, there we go. We have it written down somewhere. I don't. It's about $40. Make sure that you tender that. Otherwise, that person does not have to show up. Let's see here. Requests to admit. Those ones get a little bit sticky. I do like to use those on occasion to narrow the scope of litigation and get some clarity on potentially some basic issues. If you're on the receiving end of a request to admit, here's the kicker. You've got to reply in time. If you don't, they're going to be deemed admitted, and it can absolutely burn you. 30 days, depending if you're a plaintiff or defendant side of things, you might not be able to get an answer from your client, or you might need to spend some additional time doing research. I get asked all the time for an extension on a request to admit. I'm always happy to grant it. Those who play nice usually do better in the end.
And Nathan, do you do a formal stipulation, or is it just by agreement of the parties?
I'm fine just by agreement of the parties. If they send me an email, I figure that that's going to hold up in front of the judge. Some folks, depending on the size of the firm, if you head south to a large town who shall remain nameless, where they have lots of tall buildings, they always want a stipulation. If they want a stip, they get to draft it because I don't feel like it. But usually it's just an informal request. Interrogatories. We're looking for additional answers, clarifications, and things of that nature. Limited to 25 per party. You've got your 30 days to respond. is a general rule. No one, if you do litigation, no one responds to discovery in time. Everybody's looking for additional time or they blow a deadline. Maybe it's just my cases, but I see kind of a pretty lax attitude towards it. Our office's policy is that unless it's an absolute emergency or we can't comply, we do respond in time. I think it keeps the case moving along and prevents undue delay. The key with interrogatories is objections, 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 I mean, with all discovery. I mean, you know, when I send out discovery and I get a response, I get usually about 3 pages of standing objections to everything that I've asked, and then they usually cough up some details at that point. Request for production of documents. We don't really see it predominantly in our bankruptcy cases, but you will up in district court, is protective orders, looking for restrictions on documents. I don't, again, see it as often in this context, but it's something that you may or may not have to duke out. I don't have a huge problem with protective orders. They usually are fairly reasonable in their scope and serve a genuine purpose. Comments from anyone?
If you are having disputes about discovery, you want to try to work them out and document that before you get the judge involved. There's really few things that judges like better than mediating over discovery disputes. So you really want to do your best to save the substantive issues for the judge to decide and try to work out discovery disputes. Now, obviously, if you've got the big jerk on the other side and you can't do it, just document, hey, I tried to get, I offered you these 4 dates to bring your client for the deposition. None of them are going to work for you. Now I'm running up against a deadline. I need to compel the appearance. I'm going to get the judge involved. But your first reaction shouldn't be, oh, I'll go just take it to the judge. It should be to try to work it out and then cover your base with that so that you can show the judge, I tried to be reasonable. These are the efforts I made. Similarly with sanctions, and you want to try to see what you can do before you involve the judge is a good idea.
That's a good comment. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we have a provision in our local rules, but if you look at the local rules for district court, there's actually a whole complete section on needing to confer and the various steps that go along with it. We usually try to follow something along those lines, even in a bankruptcy context, to make sure that if we do get it in front of the judge, that we're not the bad guy and that we couldn't have done something more. And I think that that's just a best practice at that point. Jack, I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about Rule 2004 examinations. Mostly we see these exams used by creditors to examine a debtor. Usually a creditor will show up at a 341 meeting, but as we all know, those are really short. A creditor can't get that much information. So if they want to examine the debtor more, they file a motion for authority to conduct a 2004 exam. And I should note that these are for use only in an underlying bankruptcy case. You can't use them in an adversary proceeding. So these Rule 2004 exams, they're similar to depositions, but there are a few key differences. The first one is the notice for your motion for authority to enter into a 2004 exam or to conduct a 2004 exam, the notice doesn't have to be served. You really don't need notice. You can file a motion for 2004 exam ex parte. Some districts, they have local rules providing for actual notice and an opportunity to object, but we don't have that here, and the rule doesn't provide for that. And Judge, do you see most of them filed ex parte?
They say ex parte, but when you file something in the electronic docket, obviously everybody who's a party in the case,
right,
an e-filer in the case, is getting a copy, so it's not really ex parte, and I don't know what the big deal is. If there's some emergency and you don't have time to give notice, that's one thing, but I think you're silly to not say, oh, I want to take so-and-so's, the debtor's deposition. I think I've got a good non-dischargeability claim, but I want to flesh out some facts and serve the debtor's lawyer with it. I mean, I think a better practice, if that's what we're talking about, is go ahead and give them the opportunity to choose a date that you're all comfortable with and choose the scope of the documents that you're all happy with, and then everything will go smoother and cheaper, hopefully.
Okay. The second difference between 2004 examinations and depositions is the scope. With Rule 2004 exam, the scope is much broader. It's not limited to issues raised in any complaint or in a contested matter. The third difference is the procedural protections that are available in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Those generally do not apply to 2004 exams. So for example, a deposition is limited to 1 7-hour day. With the 2004 exam, I guess technically you could conduct an exam that runs longer than that. The last difference is that there is no right to cross-examine a witness at a 2004 examination, as there is with depositions. So how you would go about getting a 2004 exam, you would first file a motion with the court for authority to conduct it. In your motion, you have to explain why such inquiry is appropriate. You have to show good cause for the examination. The exam cannot be used just to harass or delay things. There's got to be good cause. And ultimately, the bankruptcy judge decides whether you can go ahead with that exam or not. The motion, it could request either deposition testimony or production of documents or both. Like a deposition or a request for production of documents, the attorney conducting the exam may submit or may issue a subpoena to compel the attendance or the production of documents. I should note that if the debtor is the one being examined, a subpoena is not required. Service of the order authorizing the exam is enough just for the debtor. And the territorial limits that Nathan went over, about the 100 miles and all that, those don't apply to a debtor. So a debtor could file bankruptcy here and then move to Iowa, and you could still, examine them.
Did you see what happened to the butter cow, by the way? The butter cow at the Iowa State Fair? Somebody threw red paint on it and said, free all the animals?
Nice. And Jack,
I think of that. I've been worried about the butter cow.
And
ever since.
And Jack, I recently had a case where the debtor did move post-filing and actually did have to come back into town for a 2004 exam, and it was able to get it coordinated, but there was no ability to object to that.
I think the only thing with that is if they live more than 100 miles away, you have to pay the mileage fee, and that's it. No witness fee or anything else. And that's provided for right in the rule. As to who can conduct the exam, and it's not always just the debtor that can be examined. The rule states that any party in interest may file a motion for the examination of any party. So, for example, the UST in any bankruptcy, they can move to examine a mortgage company, for example, if they suspect any wrongdoing by the mortgage company. So, that's pretty broad as well. The scope.
You mentioned that you could do either a document or a deposition or both. And what I see a lot is the UST, they're trying to make a case for a 707B dismissal or maybe a denial of discharge. And what they do is they find the debtor's bank and they say, they ask me for an order under 2004, produce all the records, the account records, for the last 6 months before bankruptcy or whatever it may be. And if you do that, I won't take anybody's deposition. But if you don't do that, then I want an officer to appear and explain all the debtor's transactions. So that could be, that just happens to be what the UST is doing. I can see that working for private parties as well. If you're really looking for documents, say, if you produce the documents, that's all you have to do. If you produce them by this date, you don't have to show up. So just a strategy to think about, maybe.
I often see it used by Chapter 7 trustees trying to ascertain whether or not an asset exists without spending a lot of time on a deposition or something like that, getting at least some initial documents to see whether there's something they're going to either litigate or abandon. And it's very, very cost effective, and I think that's the most important aspect about using a 2004 to gather documents.
Okay. All right, well, turning to scope, like I said, scope of a 2004 exam is very broad. However, it's not limitless. The rule itself states that the exam under Rule 2004 may relate to the acts, conduct, or property, or to the liabilities and financial condition of the debtor, or to any matter which may affect the administration of the debtor's estate, or to the debtor's right to a discharge. In addition to that, if there's a plan involved, If the debtor filed bankruptcy under Chapters 11, 12, or 13, the exam may also relate to the operation of any business, to the source of any money used by the debtor to complete a plan, and for any other matter relevant to the case or to the formulation of a plan. So, you know, you can really get a lot of information from these 2004 examinations, and how Nathan said, you know, it's very cost effective.
And I think the cases refer to it as a fishing expedition. I mean, a lot of times you'll hear in a deposition, objection, you're just irrelevant, you're just going on a fishing expedition. You know, that might be okay in a deposition, but in a 2004, you know, might be a good objection, but in a 2004, it is a fishing expedition. That's the point of it, find information.
And if anyone's been through who does debtor work, has been through a 2004 exam with the good folks from the United States Trustee's Office, it genuinely feels like a fishing expedition at moments, that you have no idea really where this is going or if it has any relevancy. And some very interesting and sometimes disturbing things come up. But there's nothing you can really do at that point, but let them keep on going.
Okay. Does anybody have any more comments about the 2004 exams?
Jack, can you use the testimony or documents that you get in a later adversary proceeding or other motion before the court?
I don't see why not. It's within the same bankruptcy. I know it's the same matter. I know if it was a different case, probably not, but if it's within the same case, I think so. I don't know the answer for sure.
I would look at just similar idea of using, you know, deposition testimony. I mean, you've got potentially some hearsay related issues. But I think
the regular evidence rules would govern it. So if you want to use it for impeachment, for example, that's perfectly fine. But if you've got, if the witness is available, you know, the evidence, things may be different. But I would consider the transcript of the exam just like a deposition transcript. And whatever you could use a deposition transcript for, you could use that 2004. Similarly, the documents, if they're going to be admissible under the rules of evidence, they're going to be admissible whether you got them through deposition or 2004 or using your trustee powers to say turn over information to me as a trustee.
And I think under depositions, I listed kind of three of the main ways you get around the hearsay issue is statement against interest, contradict testimony at trial, or the deponent unavailable. And I'm thinking of a case, Doug, that you and I have where one of the parties is very, very old. And there's an actual concern that if we do go to trial, she won't be alive at that point in time. Obviously, we want to get as much deposition testimony, or we could have even done Rule 2004, as possible, so we've got something to use at a later point in time.
Do you have to use a court reporter for 2004 exam, or can you just record it?
No, the rule provides for, I don't think it has to be a court reporter, but there has to be an officer there that can administer and hold a 2004 exam. So I think if you use a video at a deposition, Nathan, you might have done a deposition when you use a video.
Yeah.
You also have a court reporter.
Yes. We kind of do the belt suspenders. We'll do audio, video, and court reporter. I know that from a cost standpoint, sometimes it's better to use to just do an audio recording than if you need to generate a transcript later on. You can do that, especially if, you know, you're under more of the fishing expedition. You don't know where this is going to go, and you don't want to spend a lot of money. Court reporters can add up. Especially looking at Doug as a Chapter 7 trustee, if this case, you know, you're researching whether or not an asset exists and you're not sure if any funds are going to come into the estate, you might not want to drop $400 or $500 on a court reporter.
Who normally puts the witness under oath?
If there's a court reporter there, the court reporter would put the witness under oath because they're usually a notary. If I know that the UST's office often will not have a court reporter there for budget purposes, and then whatever trial attorney is conducting the 2004 exam, as an officer of the court, will swear the person in. That's at least what I've experienced.
You can also go to a court commissioner's office, too, and have them just swear it.
That's true.
Swear it in.
And then just record the proceeding?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Doug?
Nate or Jack, are you going to advise your client of the Fifth Amendment going to a fishing expedition rule 2004?
Well, I know there's case law saying that you can't really assert a Fifth Amendment privilege in 2004 examination, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's a good question, though.
let's say, you know, there's a $100,000 undisclosed bank account and USD or the trustee's conducting a rule 2004, getting US bank records, and you know what the focus is going to be.
Well, I've never advised a client. I think my previous job, yeah. Ever do that? I don't know.
I've never seen it. I don't know that I've had anybody mess up that badly. I've been worried about criminal prosecution. We didn't get into it. There's a little bit of interesting case law, and this actually came up in a recent hearing about a dispute on scheduling the 2004 exam on whether or not there's a right to have counsel present and things of that nature. It's some really weird case law, at least in my opinion. I think it's out of Delaware somewhere on some, you know, mega Chapter 11 type of case. The way it works from a practical standpoint, if you notice these things up and the party's represented by counsel, counsel's obviously going to be there and attending, and, you know, things move forward. Pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Nothing more, I'll hand it over to Melissa.
Or
Jack, you've got for trial?
We can briefly go over some pre-trial motions. Most of these motions, you file them with the court, and you're basically asking for a ruling on particular matters that could end litigation before things go to trial. A common one, the first one I've listed in the outline, is motion for summary judgment. It's straightforward. This is where one party, and this is usually after discovery, summary. One party says, look, judge, even if the facts are the way that the other side has described them, my client is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And if the judge agrees with you, things are done, you get your judgment, and you proceed. If not, it means that there probably is a big fact that's in dispute, at least one, and things go to trial, and things are fleshed out that way. The second, and this is probably
and
the
I,
most...
You know, and I don't know how to put this without... But none of the other judges are here, and we'll not put this on the... When I was a lawyer, I thought summary judgment was the greatest idea ever. I mean, I don't have to worry about trial and cross-examining and knowing all the hearsay rules. I can just write it all down and have affidavits and win. And I thought it was great, but then I would do it and I wouldn't win. And now that I'm a judge, I see the problem. It's a lot. It's harder to do than you think it is. It's not every case is good for it. Cases like dischargeability, where you're talking fraud, where you're talking willful malicious conduct, these are not good candidates for summary judgment. As much as you'd like to not have to go to trial on them, unless you already have a state court that has found the elements, that's a good candidate. But if you're just going to say, you know, this is fraud. Clearly he lied on this financial statement and intended to deceive the bank. Those are tough. The judge would just rather see the witnesses and make his or her own decision. You really have to think about what kind of case you have. Now, you have a preference case where it's a very numbers issues, you know, like, is this the ordinary course of business or not? That might be different. But if you have one of our more typical bankruptcy disputed adversary proceedings, dischargeability, discharge, unless, like I say, if you already have the element, then you can claim issue preclusion or collateral estoppel or whatever. They've changed the name, and I still am confused by it. That's different. But I really do warn you to think long and hard. If it's a case that can be tried in a half a day or less, or even a day, just go and try it. Let the judge look at the witnesses and do it. I don't know what you think as lawyers, but it really, to me as a judge, I now see the problem that it's hard to say there's no material facts in dispute. A lot of things can turn on credibility. A lot of things that turn on intent are hard to find on summary judgment.
Well, I think just getting the parties to agree to some form of stipulated facts can be difficult, if not impossible. And if there's no agreement as far as with the facts that exist, then you're not moving forward. But I think it's on preference recoveries, things where you're looking at ideas of tracing or ordinary course, you might stand a chance of getting there. If you're looking at valuing an asset or something else of that nature, or whether or not something's bad faith, that's absolutely going to move to trial, in my opinion.
Okay. All right, the next motion I've listed, it, and this is probably the most common one that the judges see, is motion for default judgment with lien stripping, for example. Here, you know, a complaint's filed, and perhaps there's no answer to the complaint filed. You would then file a motion for default judgment, say, look, there's no answer, everything's deemed admitted. In this district, I know we do have some differences with how motions for default judgment are handled. Judge Kelly, I know you always have a prove-up hearing.
Right.
After.
Although I don't no longer require the debtor to come and testify unless you want her to or him to. You can come with an affidavit. But I think it's important, again, everybody seems to be in this mindset, and maybe it's from state court practice where things are a little more cut and dry, but if you lose or you didn't answer, you lose and you get your judgment. That's not necessarily the case. There's two steps. First, you get default. That means they didn't answer. Then the issue is, are you entitled to a judgment? Do you have a prima facie case entitling you to this judgment? And I learned in the Western District with Judge Martin, and it's a matter of proving up your case. And that's why I have the practice of having these prove-up hearings and not going on what you said in the complaint. But I will take evidence in the form of a declaration under penalty of perjury or an affidavit, but again, it's got to prove up the case. It can't just say, and I have had lawyers try this, Bank of America did not answer, therefore I'm entitled to a judgment. No, you're entitled to default, they're in default, but to get a judgment, you have to show me what's the value of the property, who's got the first mortgage, and how much is it? You know, does the debtor own the property? Put the elements that if they had answered, you would be kind of proving up at trial. And I think, again, if you come on back in October, we'll really drill into some of these elements. But just in general, that's kind of my philosophy. And I think Judge Pepper is kind of in that same school of thought, that you can't just, because they didn't answer, get whatever order you want. You have to show her, okay, who's got the mortgage? The mortgage you attached is in the different name than the person that you're now suing. Show me what happened there. And I know it's hard. We're not saying this is, you know, that, you know, her 11-year-old could do this. He couldn't. But you have to help us through. Otherwise, the big fear is 5 years down the road, debtor goes to sell the house. Now a title company's looking at this and going, hey, I see where you got a lien strip against this bank, but the mortgage is really in this bank. You got to do something about this mortgage now. That's what we're trying to help you with. That's what we're trying to do, to make your lien strip effective down the road when the debtor needs it to be effective. So It is hard to trace through who's on first, who's on second. And you do have to say your elements either in testimony or in an affidavit, for at least me and I think Judge Pepper as well.
Yeah, I do believe Judge Pepper requires some type of a prove-up affidavit. Essentially, give me the elements that you would have established, you know, at a hearing and lay it out. I think you do hit on an important point. It's either the declaration under penalty of perjury or an affidavit. The difference being the declaration doesn't have to be notarized, whereas the affidavit does. And I believe that's my understanding of how those two work.
I don't know that. I only know that it says in the federal rules that any time it says affidavit, you can use a declaration under penalty of perjury.
Okay. Like Judge Kelly said, I think Judge Pepper is... she has the same thought. Along with your motion for default judgment, she wants an affidavit by counsel included, just indicating what you would have proved at trial. I know she won't have the prove-up hearing, though. I think she usually takes it off. I think Judge McGarity works the same way. And I'm not sure what Judge Helfinger's procedure is.
Do you prefer documents with your affidavit, such as tax, real estate tax, valuation, or a realtor's valuation with your, not just the debtor claiming what they think the property is worth. So if your affidavit, if you want to avoid a hearing, a prove-up hearing, give your give your proof.
Sure. And just to reiterate what Judge McGarity's law clerk said.
If you don't attach all that, then we would have a proof of hearing.
Okay. Judge McGarity's law clerk just said, for those of you that can't hear her, she said that Judge McGarity would prefer that documents be attached to the motion for default judgment and affidavit showing what the fair market value is, what the balance of the first mortgage is, and things of that nature.
She wants an independent proof of valuation, is what she said. She wants a realtor BPO or a tax bill. Is tax bill good enough, Chris?
Yes.
Tax bill works.
Tax bill. Just the debtor showing, or not showing, just the debtor saying that, oh, my first mortgage is more than what my house is worth, is not enough for Judge McGarity.
And again, come back in October and we'll drill down in this even more.
Okay. Another interesting one, I guess, is a pretrial motion is a motion in limine. We don't see a lot of these, and this isn't the type of motion that would necessarily get rid of things before trial. This type of motion is used to exclude evidence prior to trial. So any party can file it. It arises when a party anticipates an evidentiary issue that would come up at trial. So either party can move for an advanced ruling. Like I said, the proponent of whatever is in dispute can make a motion for an advanced ruling on admissibility. The opponent can also make an advance objection prior to trial. And this type of motion is probably used more where there's a jury, where a defendant doesn't want any mention of any evidence to be heard by the jury at all. However, it probably is helpful in some bankruptcy cases as well. For example, if you want to eliminate any evidence or any argument which could save a lot of time, you'd file this type of motion. And in bankruptcy, for example, you could use it to exclude improper evidence due to a privilege, evidence that wasn't discussed in settlement negotiations. That can't be used at trial, of course, or the use of deposition from another proceeding. So that's all I have on pretrial motions. Does anybody else have any comments?
Jack, what about amending the complaint? Did you guys think about talking about that at all?
I'm going to turn to Heidi because she and I have recently were dealing with this. It's a district court case, but if you want to weigh in on some of the...
To amend the complaint, you'd want to file, or in district court anyway, we file for a motion for leave to amend the complaint.
Right. I think until the answer is filed, you have the right to amend the complaint. So sometimes we'll see your complaint comes in and we go, oh my God, there's problems here. We don't want to create any more, so we might say to you, or maybe at the pretrial conference when they haven't answered, before we get to a motion for default, you want to amend this complaint. And I think until the answer is filed, you have the right to amend it as of right. So you can go ahead and file a motion, if you will, if you want to, and your amended complaint. My issue was, and I've heard this, but I wondered what your practitioner's experiences, that the event in CM to amend the complaint is difficult to find and navigate. Do you have experience with that?
I just amended a complaint and I found it very easy. Okay. But I wasn't doing a motion because at a hearing the judge granted us the right to amend.
Okay.
Where I would think you'd want to do, if you didn't have a right to amend, you'd want to file the motion.
If this
first.
Is tripping anybody up, and Sean and Janet were here, but I think they had to go to another meeting. But definitely come on back in October, and we will, as one of our things we'll cover, is exactly walking through, if you do need to amend your complaint, how do you do that, not just substantively, but procedurally in CM.
One of the things about amending the complaint, at least if you're in district court, you file a motion for leave to amend, and then you actually attach the amended complaint.
You absolutely have to do that
like an exhibit.
Court too. Right.
And, it's always, you're obviously tipping your hand to opposing counsel about where you might be going with the case, but it gives them at least a basis for why they may want to object or not, whether their rights have been discriminated or impaired.
Right. Any final thoughts?
I'll just explain quickly what else was included. There's at the end of the outline, there's just a list of the local rules that kind of relate broadly to that relate broadly to the topic we're talking about today. And then also included are some pretrial orders or trial procedure orders from each of the judges. Each of the judges does it a little bit differently, but it you can see how each of the judges would address discovery deadlines, expert and witness deadlines, and things like that. So.
Great. Yeah, the materials are really great, and for those of you here, pick up the new Judge Kelly form of summons. Thanks so much to Heidi, Melissa, Nathan, and Jack for this presentation. Don't come back in September to the Lewy homes. Do come back Friday, September 13th at noon for the Pro Se Help Desk seminar. Thank you so much. Thanks, guys. That was great.